On this episode of Newton Talks, I'm joined by filmmaker Andrew Elias. This is an episode I've been wanting to do for a long time, ever since I saw the trailer to his new movie, Tales from the Great War, which looks absolutely fantastic. Andrew's here to join me today to talk about the production of the movie, how he got into filmmaking in the first place, and also his philosophy behind the style and the narrative of Tales from the Great War. But before Andrew joins us, let's start by listening to the trailer.
I wondered if you could help me.
You be careful what you wish for.
Is this what I get with my money?
I need 4 volunteers. You, and you.
Who the hell am I talking to?
Well, it is. Fritz is on the run. We're going to gather some information. See what we can find out. Bring your tools.
Andrew, your new film is called Tales from the Great War. Can you tell us a bit about the synopsis for that movie?
Yeah, it's three separate stories that each follow an individual protagonist, I guess, that all kind of converge together. The stories all meet on the Western Front on one night. We kind of see a little bit of background before they get to the Western Front. But they all meet in this one place on this one night.
Andrew, the film looks absolutely great. And I noticed in there some horror elements in the trailer. What were the origins for the story? What were the origins for the production? Was it purely based on what you were thinking, or did you have access to particular locations or props or costumes that prompted the story?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting listening to a couple of the other podcasts with the other filmmakers, and particularly with Charlie when he was talking about the use of location and having a location and seeing what they could do with the location. In the case of Tales from the Great War, I basically wrote the script, and it was one of those things that I thought, this is probably never going to get made because it's set in World War One, and I really don't know how to do this. And then I started thinking, well, you know what, I'll just shoot it anyway and just see what I can get hold of and just see, you know, who'd be willing to let me use their property or their location to shoot in. And so we did this first kind of shoot back in 2020. It was in between the lockdowns. There was this little avenue in the summer, and I just wanted to shoot this scene that was in the woods, and it has a flashback to the woods from the Western Front. At the very start of the war. And I approached loads of places to film in the woods, you know, that wouldn't mind us running around with a couple of guns. And a lot of places weren't too happy about that. Even, you know, some of the big organizations that own land in this country, you know, they wanted an extortionate amount of money for what we're going to do. So eventually I remember there was this local museum. It's like a museum of industrial work and heritage, and it's in an old quarry in Amberley, and I've been there several times. My dad used to volunteer up there in the print room, so I asked him and said, you got a bit of woods there, do you mind if we come in and film? And they said, yeah sure, just come in. You come in at 10, you can stay till 4. There's no one on site, the museum's closed, it's just people in doing maintenance, and they basically let us go where we want. didn't charge us a penny, said, you know, you do what you want. So that was fantastic. So we got the ball rolling, really, with that scene. And then obviously the trench scenes themselves were a little bit trickier. But I found this place in Kent that was mostly used for educational purposes. It's like this lad has built this trench system on his dad's farm. And I just contacted him and he phoned me back straight away and said, well, we're really quiet at the moment because all the school bookings have been cancelled. So yeah, I can give you these dates. I can do you a really good deal if you come down for 3 nights, throw in uniforms, weapons, everything else. So I was like, okay, let's do it. So we did. And that was pretty much it. So, I mean, initially when I was thinking of the trenches, I was getting to the idea that I might have to cheat it all and just dig a hole in a mate's garden and just kind of be very clever with the camera. But actually it worked out for the best in the end. We got this fantastic location in Kent.
And what about I noticed in the trailer, there are scenes set in a theatre as well. There's a kind of theatre, I don't know whether that's just one of the stories or whether that's a framing device for your entire movie, but there's the scene where you've got almost kind of, is it a music hall scene or kind of old vaudeville scene in that?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, I wanted to go for that whole musical vibe. And again, there's this place over in Rotherhithe, I don't know if you've heard of it, called the Sands Film Studios. And it's basically an independently run film studio. It's been running since about 1975. And a couple of years back, I went to a screening there of The Good Soldier Spike, which is a fantastic film about kind of every man. Again, set in World War One. I think he's maybe fighting for the Austrians or something, but he keeps trying to get into war. And every time something happens that stops him getting to war, so it almost makes him seem like he's a coward, but he's not. But anyway, I went to the screening. There was only about two people in the audience. And afterwards, I got chatting to the owner of the studio, this lovely lady there, and she lives above the studio. And she gave me a guided tour of the place. And we came onto this theatre set. And I was like, well, what's this? And she said, oh, we built it for The Good Soldier Psych that we were filming. Yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And, you know, the seed was sown. I approached a couple of other theatres and a couple of music halls in London. And again, the prices were extortionate. So now I thought, oh, I'll give Emma a ring at Sands Film Studios, see what they say. And then, yeah, they were really willing and really up for it and gave me a really, really good deal as well. So, yeah, fantastic. I mean, I think, I don't want to say it was because of coronavirus. I think they're very select in things they kind of do there. But I think it was up their street. I think they like the musical World War One, slightly sinister element. So yeah, that worked in our favour, and it's a fantastic place. If you ever get to go there, I know Tom Rutter was there with us on set, and he was in his element. He loved it.
Yeah, I noticed that Tom obviously plays the part of what do you call it, the MC in music hall, the person who introduces the show. So tell us something about the casting process, because that was on the next on my list of questions, because I noticed you've got a lot of people who are what I guess names on the UK indie scene. So I noticed Annabella Rich in one of the roles. I've brought Annabella on my current film, Caternicum, which I'm editing right now. And she's fantastic. You've got Tom Lee Rutter, who's a Midlands filmmaker who appeared on another one of my podcasts. And did I see Michael, is it Fosty there in the film as well?
Yeah, Mike, the director of Exit, which is a fantastic film, if you've seen that. He does a nice little part in it as well. Also, I don't know, did you, if you saw Kamal, Kamal's the director of a film called The Haunting of the Lady Jane, which is set on a canal boat. I think he shot that up sort of Shropshire way. So again, he's very much involved in the indie horror scene. Yeah. So it's great to have him on board as well.
Absolutely. And that was a question I was going to ask you, because I know Annabella does some writing. Tom, and the other guys are obviously directors themselves. So was there something, was that a deliberate thing? We deliberately inviting directors to perform, or was that just accidental? Or did you notice anything different between the way that directors performed and the way professional actors performed?
Well, it's really interesting because, I mean, it was ultimately it was accidental. But I met Tom and Mike at Horror on Sea in 2020, just before the first lockdown. And I really liked them. I really liked their films and I really liked their ethos and their attitude towards filmmaking. And when I was thinking of shooting the scenes in the music hall, you know, Tom came to mind. I'd done a little cameo on his pocket film of Superstitions. We were filming in the Holst Museum, which was great. It was just kind of like a walk by on the stairs. But he's just very relaxed on set. And he said something to me that kind of resonated with me. He said that it's great having other filmmakers on set because we all speak the same shorthand. And the shoot I was on with Tom on his film, there was a couple of other filmmakers. In fact, all four of us on the shoot were all filmmakers in our own right. So it was a very easy set and, you know, nothing really needed explaining. Everyone just kind of got on with it and knew what they were doing. So then that made me think as well, oh, well, Tom would be brilliant because I've seen him act in a few things. And I thought it'd be great for the compere. It'd be a nice little role for him. So I asked him and he said, yeah. And I think it was his first time out of the Midlands since the coronavirus. He came down to London for that day. So it was brilliant. It was really good to see him. And, you know, I didn't give him any direction really at all. I just said, gave him the script. I mean, I only gave him his segment of the script as well. So totally no context at all, just his character and what his character needed to know. And he really developed the character himself. So I kind of thought, you know what, I'm just going to let him roll with it. And he'd blacked out his teeth. He'd made himself look really sleazy. So it worked perfectly.
Was that a strategy you employed with the rest of the cast, only showing them their scenes or their section?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much I noticed the other podcasts I've listened to of yours, you know, a lot of the filmmakers working at this level have two major issues, and that seems to be location and cast. And I generally, with casting, I generally try and work with people that I've either worked with before, so I know that they're actually going to turn up, you know, because there's that constant worry that on the day someone's not going to show up, or that they've been recommended to me. With Mike, I wanted to get Mike Fausti in on a cameo anyway, at the start of Exit. You know, he's on the phone and I had this character that is an officer that's on the phone, and I thought that's just a nice little nod to Exit. Kamal sent me a message. I hadn't met him before, but I was aware of his work, and he sent me a message saying, have you got any roles going for Tales from the Great War? And I thought about it, and actually, the character that he played originally, I'd written two young characters, the two kind of young lads. But I thought, actually, you know what, it'd be quite a nice element if we have more of a father-son relationship between him and Peter Tilly, the actor playing alongside him. And actually, what Kamal brought to the set was brilliant, because not only did he adopt this fatherly role as characters, he kind of took Peter, it was Peter's first feature film, and he kind of took Peter under his wing off screen as well. And it was a really nice relationship between them, which I think translates brilliantly in their scenes in the film.
So you started yourself as an actor, I believe. So you've got kind of, would you say you've got a lot of experience working with cast? Do you feel that's where you're most comfortable talking to people in terms of performance? Or do you feel more comfortable when it comes to designing the shots or designing the sequences? What would you say where your comfort zone is regarding directing?
I think working with the actors is probably where I feel most comfortable. But again, I'm quite a hands-off director. I'm not like a dictator director that says, you know, you must walk over here now and then use your left hand to pick up this glass and take a sip from the glass and then put the glass back down. I really don't feel that that works for me. I kind of like to give the actors a lot of ownership over their part. So, you know, send them the script, see what they come up with, essentially. If there's anything that really jars with me, that's when I'll probably step in. But otherwise, just let them have free reign, because being on the other side of it, I've worked with some directors that are really real control freaks, and kind of treat the actors a bit like puppets in part of their big show, you know. And I feel that the actors have a lot to offer, because the role of the director is a relatively modern concept. If you look at, you know, acting's been around for hundreds of thousands of years, but the role of the director as such is a relatively modern addition to a performance. So I kind of feel like the actors, they generally know what they're doing. Younger actors, less experienced actors perhaps need a little bit more guidance, but the older, more experienced ones, I just let them get on with it.
I won't ask you to name the names for who the tyrant directors are.
They're long gone.
Even though I do want to know, I won't ask you to tell me. So you're in the film as well, Andrew. So you play. Yeah. Have you got a big part? You certainly take a big part in the trailer. You seem to be the character who sets the whole story in motion. Would I be right in assuming that?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not vanity reasons. I always say this to people. It's purely economics, really. And also, it's just a lot simpler. I don't have to, you know, I know the character and I just think, oh, well, I can do their character. That's fine. I don't need to sit down and pep talk myself or run through lines or anything. I just go with it. And it just means it's one less actor that I have to worry about on set, because I can just focus on what I'm doing. So I guess that's it. I kind of relate him to, if you're familiar with the play The Lower Depths by Gorky, I kind of think he's a kind of Luca type character, who Luca comes into this doss house in Moscow and just kind of gives all this wisdom, but he's actually full of hot air. And I think he's a bit like that.
I watched your first film, your first lengthy film was called The Numbers. What year was that? Was that 2018? Am I right?
Yeah, that's right.
And stylistically and narrative-wise, it seems to have a few crossovers with Tales from the Great War, in that it's also got this kind of slight anthology feel to it, three different tales that intersect across different time zones with different chapters. You've got one thing I noticed, which is really impressive, certainly in The Numbers and certainly in the Tales from the Great War trailer that I've seen, is the moving camera, the drone shots, and you know, particularly the Steadicam movement that you've got in Tales from the Great War looks really high quality, gives the film some real kind of movement and makes it very cinematic. And there's a very polished style you seem to have in both of these films. Can you tell us something about The Numbers? I think it's 48 minutes long, so it's a kind of mini feature or long short. Can you tell us something about that, how that came about, the budget, how you made it, and what you took over into Tales from the Great War?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was, you know, I like short films. I like short film as a medium in itself. I think, you know, the first films were all short, you know, and I think I've always liked getting involved in shorts. And with The Numbers, I had this idea that I wanted to make this short about this lift. And, this story of, you know, the story actually in The Numbers, now that the character is female, but when I originally wrote the story about the lift, it was a male character. And I was going to play that character myself just for sake of ease. But I kind of got carried away and I started thinking, well, I could link something else in here and I could do something else. And so, I mean, I worked with a great cinematographer, Dan, and I think I drive him absolutely bonkers, because with The Numbers, I just said, we're going to, you know, yeah, I've got this great film. We're going to shoot it. We'll do it in a couple of days, Dan. It's fine. And he kept saying to me, can I see the script? And I was like, yeah, I'll send you the script. I was still writing the script. We were just kind of shooting as we were going, and it was changing all the time. But he's a very patient man. And I think by the time we got to the last scenes, which was like the top and tail, those scenes set in 1912, I'd actually got around to storyboarding it and doing a shot list for him. And I think that made his life a hell of a lot easier. So he came aboard. He wasn't put off by that. So for Tales from the Great War, he was up for that again. But this time, what we did very differently, we didn't have the luxury with the numbers, is we basically blocked out every scene beforehand. We went, you know, went to each location a week or a couple of weeks before. He brought a camera. I basically stepped in and did all the roles, and we just blocked it all out. So on the day when we got there, like in the theatre, we went up there before, blocked out everything. He recorded it. We had a look at it. So when we were ready to go in on the day, it was a lot easier just to hit the ground running. And I knew exactly where I wanted the actors to be. He knew exactly what setup he wanted. And it worked really well. I wanted to, with the numbers, I just wanted to make a film that had a certain stylistic element to it, almost overly stylistic. So like in the bookshop, this kind of sense of orange, you know, it's a bit overboard, but just wanted it to look good, you know, just wanted it to, because we shot it for $5,000 all in all, and just wanted it to look really, to prove that we could do something with a minimum budget and actually make it look half decent. And the same with Tales from the Great War, although I guess it's a bit more ambitious, but again, we want it to look fairly decent. So if, you know, someone off the street just decided one day they were just going to watch this film that they just came across, they would go, oh, actually, that's all right. That's not too bad. It looks all right. The acting's pretty good. Story's okay. So it wasn't just like, you know, me running around with a camera in a field with a load of mates doing really bad acting.
So when you don't have to tell me the budget, by the way, for Tales from the Great War, if you don't have to, but again, you give us a sense of the kind of allocation of resources, just for people out there who are thinking about making a film themselves or thinking about how to mount a project this ambitious. So where do you, if you've $5,000 budget on the numbers, how much of that is on casting? How much of that is on locations? How much of that is on catering, et cetera, et cetera? And similar percentage allocations on Tales from the Great War. Have you got something to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of offsetting. So what I can save with one thing, like say for me playing a part, I don't have to pay myself. I can then channel those funds into something else. And again, working with other filmmakers, we kind of understand each other. So with Tom, I'll go and work for Tom on Tom's film. And I wouldn't expect him to pay me anything because I feel that he could use his, you know, I wouldn't even want travel expenses because I feel that he could use those expenses somewhere in the film. And I'm thinking of the film as a whole and him having it done. And I think there's that real understanding between filmmakers, which is tricky when using professional actors, obviously, because, you know, they want to get paid. It's their job. But with other filmmakers, and that's probably why I've got so many in the film, we have this understanding where we kind of help each other out. And, you know, any of those guys that are involved in it, if they ask me to be involved in their film, you know, I jump in a shot to help them. So I do a lot of offsetting of things. I've been very lucky with locations, with the numbers. A lot of it was shot in my flat. We just dressed my living room different ways. So the tea room scene was my living room, but shot from outside. Then we had Colin on the phone. That was in the living room. The whole fortune teller thing was in our living room as well. We just dressed it up. And then a lot of the other scenes we did, we shot at a friend's house just around the corner. It's got a massive house that used to be a pub. And they converted it into their family home. And, you know, he just lets me come in there. And so we did the shot with Colin on the stairs. Was at theirs. The piano was at theirs. The lift actually was in their kitchen. We built the lift, just the facade of the lift and the doors and everything, and just slotted it into their kitchen. So things like that save us a fortune, because we make all the props ourselves, make the set ourselves, dress the set ourselves, and generally try and use whatever we have at our disposal in terms of good-willed friends that are happy for us to come in and spend a couple of days in their house.
Let's get back to Tales from the Great War. So you've mentioned a little bit about how you put it together and how you shot it. Did you shoot it in kind of piecemeal ways, or did you shoot it over a period of time, or was it in, you shot one section and then another section and you had months in between? What was the production process and the shooting schedule like?
Well, the first, that scene we did in the museum in the woods, that was in the summer of 2020. And then the next kind of bit we did was the theatre, the music hall. And that was one day around sort of April 2021. Then we did pretty much 5 days together. And that was 2 days doing interiors and a couple of exteriors down in Littlehampton. And then the following week, we went down to the trenches for the 3 nights. And again, they were fantastic there. I mean, it's on a farm, like I said, and the guy that runs the farm was brilliant. You know, we were up till 4 o'clock in the morning. He didn't mind. They were just very accommodating. So been very lucky with locations, because sometimes you feel like you're racing against the clock. And actually, in terms of themes, you know, both films, you mentioned the similarities. Both films have this kind of fortune teller type character in it. Both films have a theatre in it. Both films have a bookshop in it as well. So originally, when I wrote Tales from the Great War, I was going to get the same actor who was playing the fortune teller in The Numbers, Pavand, to come back and be in Tales from the Great War. So that's what I'd written that in mind, as almost like a prequel to The Numbers, or to part of The Numbers, I guess. But unfortunately, she's a very established theatre actor and theatre maker, and she was off on tour, so we couldn't get her. So I did a couple of script changes. So stylistically, there's a lot of things that are the same. It's very much a relative of The Numbers, but it's not a direct sequel or anything anymore.
So what would you say was, I mean, you've probably gone through some of this, but what's the problems you encountered? Were there any issues you were having on set? Would you say that it went relatively smoothly? I mean, nothing ever goes smoothly when you're making a film, but was it as smooth as you could have hoped for?
Yeah, it went relatively smoothly. And I think a lot of it was, you know, with the numbers, we had some real hiccups. Like we had, you know, a makeup lady walk off set because she had a massive bust up with her partner, literally on the, you know, we just got to set, the actors had turned up to be made up, and then she was on her phone having a massive blowout with her partner, and so that's it, I've got to go. We had some major issues with The Numbers, but I think because we were prepped better for Tales from the Great War, because me and Dan blocked out everything, that alleviated a lot of the stress. Also, I think because with the trenches, because we were there and we had 3 days there and we could film through the night, there was less need to, you know, less clock watching, thinking, oh, no, we've got to be out in an hour, we've got to be out. What scenes are we going to lose, you know? Relatively smooth. We only had, there was one scene that we had to cancel because one of the actors got another gig like the night before somewhere up north and wouldn't be able to make it down. That was a real fly in the ointment, but could have been worse.
So in terms of the influences for this film, generally in terms of your influences anyway as a filmmaker, what would you say they are?
I would say really the influences are more kind of TV based than film based. I think being a kid in the 70s, being brought up on things like Armchair Thriller, Tales of the Unexpected, Hammer House of Horror. And, you know, in the 70s, you just kind of sat and watched those things with your family. You know, I've got an older brother, so just as a family, we just watch those things on telly, and that kind of, I really love the Britishness of it. Well, I appreciate now the Britishness of it, And then obviously in my teen years, I got more into American horror, especially with all the video nasties of the 1980s. But actually the film that I would say made the biggest impression on me in terms of what I want to do as a filmmaker was probably David Lynch's version of The Elephant Man. I just think it's a masterpiece of filmmaking. I guess that's probably my influences come mainly from that sort of TV of the 70s. I mean, there was a lot of horror on telly in the 70s. I don't know how our generation grew up to be well-adjusted adults, if we are, because, I mean, there was so much stuff. I remember watching, like, The Omen with my parents, and my parents were quite religious, and I thought they would probably wanted me to watch it to know that, you know, if I sinned, chances are my head would get sliced off by a pane of glass from a lorry, back of a lorry, or a spire would fall off a church and impale me in the churchyard. So, you know, that's kind of the influences. And with Tales from the Great War, it was more just weird family members telling me stories about stuff from their childhood. And I thought, oh, that'd be an interesting story to put on film. And that kind of led me down that route.
Well, there's a personal element to Tales from the Great War as well. Some of these stories are kind of family folklore.
Yeah, massively. And actually, what I really wanted to explore in the film is this idea that, you know, some stories have been around for hundreds of years and then they just stop, you know, they're lost. And I think particularly because of the events of the 20th century, a lot of the kind of folklore, yes, it's just been lost amongst technological advances and everything. And one of the story set in the theatre actually, was a story that my nan told me. And she said she was from the East End of London. She said it was based in the East End. It was this churchyard and there was this statue in this churchyard. And she told me the whole story behind it. But I only found out after she died that actually her grandmother, so my great-great-grandmother, left this written account of all her children. So number one, it showed to me that working class people weren't the illiterate kind of scum that they're sometimes portrayed to be in various forms of media. She was literate. She'd written an account of all her children and where they were registered. And her oldest child was born in 1882 and was registered in Falcon Square in St. Giles in London. So I started looking into this. And it's in this area of the city of London called Cripplegate, which is no longer there. It's basically the Barbican now. The whole place was decimated during the Blitz. And so I was looking into this Cripplegate. I thought that's interesting. And then this story came up, The Vampire of Cripplegate. And it was the same story that my nana told me. But that story, The Vampire of Cripplegate, they reckon dates back to the Great Plague of 1665. So I thought, wow, this story has been knocking around then for ages, you know, for ages. And I just kind of like that, you know, this oral tradition in families where they passed on stories. And she, you know, my nan probably didn't know for sure. She was told the story as if she knew exactly where this churchyard was and everything, but she didn't. You know, someone had told her and someone had told her mom, and it had just come down the line for a couple hundred years. So, yeah, that fascinates me. So that's kind of, that story is included in the film. And then one of the other stories was my dad, on the other hand, he was born in Wales. So he wasn't a city dweller at all. But when he was about two or three, both of his parents died of TB. And he was shipped up to London because his aunt had moved to London to be a domestic, you know, get domestic service, because working class women in the 1920s, there wasn't a lot of job opportunities for them. But she'd met a guy there when she moved to London and she married him. And he was a World War One veteran. So by the time my dad went up to live with her, they were quite elderly because this was in the 40s, late 40s. And My dad was telling me this guy who adopted him, that he called dad, had really weird stories about World War One, and he said he saw some really strange stuff happening that he couldn't really explain. And then I kind of got into Arthur Machen and the Bowmen, the Angel of Mons, and I was thinking, well, there's quite a few records of weird stuff going on. So I always had it in mind that I wanted to do a World War One based weirdness type film. And Tales from the Great was the result of that. Probably didn't help that when I wrote it, I was self-medicating on morphine, this Oramorph stuff. So I knocked the script out in about 2 days. But all the actors, or everyone that saw the script, or saw their portions of the script, were all like, oh, wow, I really love it. It's really funny. So I was thinking, okay, well, it must be half decent then. Either that or that they just, you know, just trying to flatter my ego. But I thought it's all right. You know, it's not a masterpiece. It's all right. But hopefully some people will get some enjoyment out of it.
Well, the trailer certainly is highly impressive. And you showed, I think, a 7-minute section at Horror on Sea, the Horror on Sea Festival recently. How did it go down in front of the crowd, that 7-minute section?
Yeah, really well. I was really surprised. I mean, I'm always really surprised. Anyway, when we first did Horror on Sea, which was in January 2020, took the numbers there, and I'd pretty much written the numbers off at that point because we made the numbers, and then I was quite ill for a bit, so I was out of action. And then I sent it to a few festivals, and it wasn't really getting anywhere. And then I just thought, oh, well, I'll just bung it on Amazon, you know, more for the actors, because I think for actors, it's quite nice when people always say to actors, oh, what have I seen you in, or where can I see you, or whatever. So I thought, if I put it on Amazon, then at least, you know, they've got a calling card. If someone says, what have I seen you in, they can say, oh, well, I'm in a film on Amazon. It doesn't have to be an amazing film, but I think it's, for a lot of people, they'll go, oh, wow, you've got a film on Amazon. So, and then another actor called James Devereaux, who's actually a filmmaker as well, he sent me an email and said, have you tried this place, Horror on Sea? And I was like, well, I'm really skint. I can't really afford to submit to any more film festivals, and it's not going to get accepted anyway. It's just throwing away money. But then I saw there was no submission fee, so I thought, well, what have I got to lose? And it was on a 10 o'clock slot in the morning, on the Saturday morning. And I thought, well, no one's going to show up to that. They're all boozing in the casino till 2 o'clock, you know, 2 a.m. I thought, no one's going to turn up. But I was actually pleasantly surprised. There's a lot of people in there. And it had a really nice reception, and people were coming up to me afterwards and I really liked it. So I was determined to go back to Horror on Sea because I thought, what a nice, friendly, supportive place. And they're obviously not trying to rip people off because they're not charging any submission fees or anything. So when I wanted to get the ball rolling with Tales from the Great War, I shot this 7-minute section, which is old Dice's story, basically him telling this story. And it was going to be shown last year, but obviously because of coronavirus, everything was put back a year. So the films, I think, shown in 2022 should have been shown in 2021. So it was kind of a little bit, oh no, do we really need to see this now? But actually it was good, and it was a really good response. But again, everyone's so supportive there. There's not a lot of ego. There's no competition element. It's just a very kind of supportive, friendly vibe. So it went down really well.
So when can we see Tales from the Great War? What's your distribution plan for this? Have you got any deals in place, or are you waiting until it's finished before you send it out to places, or are you planning to self-distribute? What's your plan?
Yeah, I mean, I was chatting to a lot of filmmakers at Horror on Sea this year. And I don't know if you're familiar with Baz Hantcher, White Raven Films, but basically he's got a really good working model where he makes films, he releases them on DVD or Blu-ray, and then they kind of fund his next film. He gets enough sales and he's selling them all over the world. And he basically cuts out the middleman. Because the issue with like Amazon, for example, I mean, you're probably familiar with this yourself because you're a filmmaker as well. You probably know it doesn't really pay that well. I mean, it's great. It was a game changer in that you know, anyone can put anything on Amazon as long as it meets the technical specs. But I get something like 2p for every hour streamed or something like that. Because if you do it on Blu-ray or DVD, you know, you can earn substantially more if selling it, you know, if doing it yourself. Again, I hear a lot of horror stories about indie distributors, and you know, you don't actually get much of a return on it. So you may as well do it yourself, because at least then all the money comes to you and you can plow that into your next production. But ultimately, I'm going to send it to a few festivals and we'll see what happens.
And what's next for you? What's your next project? Have you got one of your own feature films that you're working on or anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple of films kind of on the go. One I've got in development is, I mean, it's really, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but then I didn't know how I was going to do a film set in World War One. So, you know, you kind of got to aim high and see where you fall. But it's set on a moving steam train. So, Victorian, I'm thinking maybe 1894, 1895, set on a moving steam train pretty much in its entirety. Again, sort of like a... very much inspired by Horror Express, you know, this idea that you're on a train, no one's getting off the train, something horrible is happening on the train. The idea I wanted to take was, I changed the date. I was going to set it in 1888 because I wanted it to be Jack the Ripper leaving London on a train. So it's basically like a Jack the Ripper movie, but on a train.
And that's what you're writing at the moment?
Yeah, that's one of them. The other one, I'm involved in this anthology horror film called Video Shot Tales of Terror, which is, again, it's working with a bunch of filmmakers. Again, a lot of it was based around Horror on Sea. So Tom's doing one, Mike Faust is doing one, MJ Dixon and Maiko is doing one. The guys from Ice Cream on the Beach are doing one. And Trash Arts down in Portsmouth, they're doing one as well. Doing a short film for that. And then I've written another film, which is a bit different. I wanted to do a kind of walking around London, but set in 1911, 1912, and just kind of shoot it a little bit more guerrilla style. So it's going to be quite tricky because... I'd have to just get a couple of actors dressed in Victorian costume to come out with me in specific locations, just with a handheld, and see how it goes. But it was just kind of that's a project I wanted just to ease back from the bigger scale filmmaking.
Andrew Elias, I just want to say thanks very much for agreeing to do this podcast. I've really, really enjoyed this chat. And I wish you all the best. And I really cannot wait to see Tales from the Great War.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on. And thanks for listening to me wittering on about all kinds of nonsense.
That was Andrew Elias. And I've put a link to Andrew's YouTube site in the description. I want to thank Andrew again for joining me today. And to thank you for listening. Newton Talks will return.